From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Donald Trump was supposed to hold a press conference this Thursday for the first time since July to explain how he'll separate himself from his businesses while in office. But he has canceled that press conference and says he'll hold one in the near future. In the meantime, with less than 6 weeks to go until his inauguration, Trump has done little to clarify how he'll avoid major conflicts of interest around the world. NPR senior business editor Marilyn Geewax is with us with more on this. Hi, Marilyn.
Hi, Jeremy.
And what about this canceling of the press conference where he was supposed to address all these issues, even though he has still not articulated a clear plan for how he's going to deal with conflict of interest issues while in office?
Well, it was going to be an exciting week for conflicts. Everyone was looking forward to this event that he said would be coming on Thursday. He's deflected questions about conflicts of interest since the election, basically saying, I'll get to you on December 15th. And here it is. It's the week where we were going to get the big reveal. But he tweeted last night that he's going to postpone this until closer to the inauguration, and he's not really providing any details. But he did say in a tweet, he said, two of my children, Dawn and Eric, plus executives, will manage the businesses. No new deals will be done during that time.
But a lot of questions about whether that really removes the conflict of interest, giving control to his children.
Right. It really doesn't solve the problem, at least as far as ethics experts are concerned. They say it still will enrich his family. They are urging him to divest, that is, to just sell everything and, you know, buy mutual funds or treasuries or something. But at the very least, it should be in a blind trust that's run by an independent entity that would not have these conflicts of interest. But it just doesn't seem that the Trump family is headed in that direction at all. You know, they've run this business, the Trump Organization, since the 1920s. So it doesn't seem like anything's going to change. And even if there were no new deals, he can certainly benefit. The family will become richer if existing businesses do better. I mean, if occupancy rates rise, that's good for business.
And there are concerns now about existing businesses in other countries and what foreign governments might do to help Trump. There's a big piece out in Newsweek today from Kurt Eichenwald going deep into a number of these potential conflicts.
Yeah, let's just take one in the Philippines. Follow along with this interesting story. There's a company called Century Properties. It's headed by a man named Jose E.B. Antonio. And Century is building a big project in the Philippines called Trump Tower. Trump has sold his name to Century in exchange for payments. We don't know the details, but, you know, presumably it's worth millions. And as luck would have it, the government of the Philippines has named a new special envoy to the United States. Jose E.B. Antonio, the guy who had Century Properties. So that means that when the president is meeting with this envoy from the Philippines to discuss U.S. policy in Southeast Asia, this is his business partner who could greatly enrich his own children there. So it's a good example of a conflict of interest, but there are many. There's also the Trump Towers in Istanbul. That's, you know, it's an office tower and there's a residential tower. Turkey is a really tricky and important country. How will that affect our business dealings and our national interest? There are just lots of places all over the world when there's a company that does business in 20 different countries, lots of opportunities for conflicts.
And it brings us to the emoluments clause, which we'll wrap up with, Marilyn. Just tell us what that is and how that might play in.
Well, there aren't really conflict of interest laws that apply directly to the president, but there is this clause in the Constitution. Emoluments is sort of this weird old-timey word that means that you can't accept gifts. The founding fathers didn't want people getting gifts from foreign governments as bribes. But it's not really, it hasn't been challenged in court. It's not really clear if it would absolutely apply to the president. So you get the gist of what the founding fathers wanted to have happen, but whether or not in these specifics it will apply to Trump, it's going to be a little bit complicated.
That's NPR senior business editor Marilyn Geewax. Much more to talk about here as we learn more about these potential conflicts. Marilyn, thanks.
Oh, you're welcome.
Well, there are reports today that former Texas Governor Rick Perry will be Donald Trump's pick to lead the Department of Energy, the same agency he famously forgot he wanted to eliminate during that 2011 presidential primary debate. Perry's nomination would be another sign that Trump is taking steps to fulfill this promise.
On regulation, I will formulate a rule which says that for every one new regulation, Two old regulations must be eliminated. So important.
Donald Trump last month laying out his plan to roll back government rules in his first 100 days. He has promised to cancel President Obama's Paris Climate Agreement, to approve the stalled Keystone XL pipeline. Business leaders want him to relax rules that limit methane gas emissions in wells, and that new rule guaranteeing overtime pay for certain workers. So how easy will this be? Susan Dudley was regulatory czar under President George W. Bush. She's now director of the Regulatory Studies Center at George Washington University. Susan, welcome.
Well, thank you, Robin. I'm happy to be talking with you.
And when we say regulatory czar, you led the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs under George W. Bush. So let's talk about some of the things that President-elect Donald Trump is talking about. He has said that he is going to roll back President Obama's efforts to limit carbon emissions at coal-fired utilities. What can happen here?
Well, regulations cannot be overturned with a stroke of a pen, unlike executive orders, which actually can be. But there are procedures for modifying or even eliminating them. It depends on the circumstances, in particular when the regulation was issued and whether other branches of government get involved.
So start with President Obama's Clean Power Plan. Again, this rollback of emissions from coal-fired plants.
Oh, that's actually a very interesting one to start with. There are several regulations that are being litigated now. And that is one of them. That is one that the Supreme Court has put on hold while litigation works its way through the state courts. What's interesting here is how President-elect Trump's Justice Department defends those regulations in court will really affect the outcome.
And so when it comes to regulations, it might be hard to completely turn them back. But how does one have to do that? Is it through Congress? Is it through drafting additions to the regulation? How would it work?
Either of those would work. So if Congress chose to write legislation that overruled the regulation, they could. For regulations that are issued in the last 7 or 8 months of the Obama administration, Congress could overturn those with simple majorities. So unlike normal legislation where they'd have to have, at least the Senate would have to have 60 votes, to overturn more recent regulations, they only need a simple majority, so 51. They would issue a congressional resolution of disapproval. Now, if that resolution were to fall on President Obama's desk, he would obviously veto it. But now, if that were to land on President Trump's desk next year, he would likely sign the resolution disapproving the regulation, and that would be the end of it.
Yeah. Let's move to finance. The Dodd-Frank bill passed after the financial crisis. Donald Trump has promised to undo that. That includes the Volcker Rule, which prohibits banks from placing risky bets with their own money. Could this be simply overturned?
Those, I think, were issued long enough ago that they couldn't be overturned with this procedure that I just mentioned. But any regulation can be changed, but the agency would have to go through the same notice and comment procedure that they need to do to put the rule in place in the first place. And that can be extensive. It involves developing a record, seeking public comment, responding to that public comment, going through interagency review, and then when they're done, there will be two records there. One, President Obama's record supporting the regulation, and the second, President Trump's record supporting a modification or elimination of it, and that is bound to be litigated. So that is a very lengthy process.
And so unless it is a stroke of a pen, an executive order, we're hearing that a lot of the things that President-elect Trump says he will do in his first 100 days are very hard to do in 100 days.
That's right. In 100 days, it would be very hard to overturn regulations unless you were working with another branch of government.
And isn't it true as well that once regulations are passed, industries, agencies, once they've started adapting to the regulation, it's awfully hard for them to completely reverse that themselves. So there's often not a lot of stomach for deregulation.
That's right. Especially companies that have invested to comply. The last thing they're going to want is for the agency to say, oh, never mind, we don't need to do that anymore, because that means their new competitors would be able to compete at an advantage. So often companies are the very ones defending regulations that are already in place.
What's your expectation of what the Trump administration will do when it comes to reversing regulations?
Well, as you noted, President-elect Trump has said that he'd like to get rid of two for every one, every new one. We have Marcus Peacock did an analysis of how one might structure that on our Regulatory Study Center website. It's not straightforward, but I do see all the things that we've been talking about. I imagine they'll work with the courts. Also, we might see regulations that are issued at the very last minute. Those I expect President-elect Trump to, the first day in office, to pull back the ones that he can.
Susan Dudley, regulatory czar under President George W. Bush, now the director of the Regulatory Studies Center at George Washington University, taking a look at what a Trump presidency might mean for regulations. Susan, thank you.
Thank you very much, Robin.
And we'll continue to take a look at regulations that might fall in a Trump administration in high tech, in pharmaceuticals, in the weeks ahead. You may have heard of revenge porn. An unsuspecting person, usually a woman, dates someone. Maybe they share a few nude photos meant just for the two of them. But when they break up, those photos suddenly appear online with vicious copy encouraging the vicious harassment that follows. There are now 33 states plus the District of Columbia that have laws protecting people from this, but there are loopholes and there's no federal law. Carrie Goldberg is a Brooklyn-based lawyer who's been defending victims of revenge porn. She's a leader in this relatively new field of sexual privacy. She heads the law firm C.A. Goldberg and joins us now. Hi, Carrie.
Hi, happy to be here.
And start with your own connection to this. You were threatened with this, weren't you?
Yes, I was originally a target. Many of my clients' cases begin with the words, I met him on the internet, and my story was actually no different. And I became somebody's target after leaving a relationship. And as soon as I resolved my problem using kind of combination of creativity and law enforcement, I decided I was going to become the lawyer I really needed when I was going through my crisis.
Well, let's just flesh that out a little bit. You were a professional. You were working as director of legal services at the Vera Institute, a criminal justice nonprofit in Manhattan. You had shared intimate photos with this man you were dating. It was threatened that they'd be put online. I know you want to talk about the women that you're now representing and this overall issue, but what is your understanding from that experience of how people feel when this happens? You know, it sounds like a combination of shame, but also rage and helplessness.
Well, there's shame, there's rage, there's helplessness. There's an attitude that the person who shared the images is some sort of sexual deviant and should have known better and should have seen the red flags. Really, in my practice, I'm here to tell the world that we are all a moment away from meeting somebody who's malicious and who's intent on taking us down. And whether that's through the use of intimate pictures or lies, the internet is this magnificent tool for malicious people to destroy one another's lives.
And that's one of the complications with the field of revenge porn. I'll list a few things. First of all, it doesn't necessarily have to be pictures that you've taken and shared with someone. You had a client that we read about in a terrific piece by Margaret Talbot in The New Yorker, who he just put her face picture. There were no intimate pictures. He insinuated that there were, and he said things about her on a porn site that were completely untrue. She had never taken photographs. And as Margaret Talbot points out, there are a lot of people who take photos of each other with today's technology, and that can be a beautiful part of a healthy romance. So there are a lot of complicating factors here. You can't assume anything about what's happened when a revenge porn case happens.
That's exactly true. I have clients who've never taken a naked picture in their life. Their face is photoshopped onto a porn star's body. I have a 13-year-old client who was engaged in a sexual act at a party, and another 13-year-old took the picture, and then he circulated it around their entire school.
You would think, when you read some of these cases, you think, well, that's got to be illegal. How can someone send you a private picture, and then that gets posted on a website? Where are we legally?
At this point, we're 33 states, plus Washington, D.C., plus Puerto Rico, have criminal laws where it's illegal criminally to take a picture that exposes somebody else's private parts or a sexual act and distribute it. But that still leaves us with 17 states where it's completely legal for me to take a picture of you and broadcast it all over the internet for everybody to see, for me to create a website that's in your first and last name and just dedicate it to exposing pictures of you.
Well, even when there is a law, are there loopholes in those laws? For instance, we understood that you had a proof that the person who was accused of disseminating pictures had to communicate directly with the victim. Does there have to be a threat of dissemination? How do these laws work?
Well, just how as we have 33 laws, we have 33 different laws. Some of them require that there be this intent to harass. And usually our harassment laws require that there be this direct communication and this pattern of conduct. Other laws just recognize that this is a privacy violation, and if the victim had an expectation of privacy when she shared the image, then it's a violation of the law for it to be shared, period.
And in cases where you've had clients and, you know, somebody has taken a photo that they sent, or in the case of Connie, the client who had her face superimposed on other bodies and put on these porn sites, what happens when you go to the police in a state where there isn't a law? Do they just say there's nothing we can do? I mean,
that's one of the biggest frustrations that clients have, is they think that they can go to the police and that they will be protected. But the police, you know, kind of have blinders on. They say, oh, well, you're telling me about revenge porn. Well, we don't have a revenge porn law. They know enough to know that. And then they send the person on the way. Unfortunately, though, they're not asking other questions. They're not asking, well, you know, did he also contact you? Many, many times, you know, clients are receiving hundreds and hundreds of texts and emails and threats. They're not asking, you know, were you of age when that picture was taken? Because it could trigger child pornography laws. Did you know the picture was taken? That could trigger unlawful surveillance laws. So often the right questions are not being asked, which would trigger criminal protection using other laws, sort of a backdoor entrance into getting the offender prosecuted.
Yeah. Well, you have been one of those trying to kick down some of these doors. The New Yorker called you a pioneer in this field of sexual privacy. The Forward named you, if I may, a kick-ass Jewish woman of the day. And you were instrumental in getting companies like Facebook, Twitter, Reddit, Google to also have policies about revenge porn. So how does that work? Because, you know, you can go through legal avenues to the state, but you can go directly to the companies that are carrying the websites. How does that work?
Well, so I'm a board member at the Cyber Civil Rights Initiative, which has just been the champion of revenge porn reformation. So we've taken this multi-pronged approach where we're going to get criminal legislation, but we're also going to go after the tech companies and get them to just voluntarily comply. And so last year, suddenly there was just this domino effect where all these social media companies decided they wanted to be good guys. And so Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Google, Yahoo, Bing, they all created these revenge porn policies and bans on their platforms. So suddenly it was so much easier for victims to at least get the content removed so that, you know, even if there were still these dedicated revenge porn websites, at least our big social media companies would remove the intimate content.
So they take things down. They also de-index revenge porn. So if there's a search for a certain person's name, it won't come up.
Right. So one of the biggest and scariest things for clients, especially the young girls, is that their Google results are trashed. So imagine you Google your name and the first five pages are populated by links to porn sites that have naked pictures of you. And then imagine you're trying to get a job or a date or an apartment. I mean, we're nothing without our online reputation. I mean, it's just there's no differentiation between our online and our offline selves.
Look, just some pushback. You know, there are people who say it's someone's own fault if they've taken the selfies, if it's their pictures, you know, just a cautionary tale. There are also people who say, look, if women want to take pictures of themselves and share them with other people, then live with the consequences. And I think the New Yorker alluded to this. If everyone's naked pictures were out there, let's all be feminists and send our naked pictures out, and it doesn't matter.
Yeah, I mean, I love that argument that, well, if people really loved their bodies, then they wouldn't care about their naked pictures being everywhere. But, you know, this is really about autonomy and about the choice to prioritize privacy in whatever way we want. I mean, we don't have sexual privacy, but yet we have consumer privacy, our social security numbers are protected, our medical information is protected. Why do we not prioritize sexual privacy the same way?
Well, and another difference between this and, let's say, you know, having your picture in a Victoria's Secret catalog that goes viral is that these women are incredibly denigrated and attacked and targeted. I mean, it's dangerous. There are death threats. And against you as well. I mean, talk about that, the unhinged nature of the people who are looking at this stuff.
Right. I mean, there are dedicated revenge porn websites, and I swear it's people's full-time hobbies or jobs to just spend all their time figuring out the names and the addresses and as much personal identifying information as they can about the people whose pictures are non-consensually on these platforms. We also have a situation where exes sometimes create fake prostitution ads on Backpage.com and Craigslist advertising their ex for sex, giving the address of their ex and saying, oh, she really likes rape fantasies and oh, this is where she works. She's going to probably ignore you or seem really confused, but, you know, just wait around until her break and then she's going to, you know, want it. And so, again, you have all these strangers that then just stalk the victims.
Well, so, Carrie Goldberg, what do you want to see? You know, there are concerns about First Amendment issues. You know, journalists, for instance, feel sometimes the need to post certain pictures because it has to do with a criminal case. I mean, you know, you can't have a federal law banning any kind of pictures of people. What would you like ultimately to see?
Well, I certainly do not want a federal law that's banning any kind of picture. I mean, there's like all our criminal laws, they can be narrowly tailored to the exact conduct that we're trying to regulate. And it's interesting to me that there's so much combat about these revenge porn laws. And there's this argument that, okay, you know, we've got enough laws, we're good, as if the evolution of technology doesn't require an evolution of law as well.
Carrie Goldberg heads the law firm C.A. Goldberg. She's an advocate for people who've been victims of revenge porn, online sexual harassment. Carrie, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average is getting very close today to hitting a record 20,000. Yesterday, it finished just a couple hundred points under that mark. Jason Bellini of The Wall Street Journal joins us from New York. Hi, Jason.
Hi, Jeremy.
And people have been talking about whether the Dow would hit 20,000 for years. Let's listen here to Seth Masters of Bernstein Global Wealth Management speaking on CNBC back in 2012.
If stocks actually grow at somewhere in the neighborhood of basically 5 to 7%, you get to 20,000 within 10 years easily.
Within 10 years, that was just about 4 years ago. Why is 20,000 considered such a big deal?
Such a big deal. Well, I think, Jeremy, that it's a psychologically important barrier. You know, the bulls, they've been itching to celebrate this milestone. And, you know, we're talking about here the Dow scoring its speediest 1,000-point gain ever. Hmm. And historically, the Dow struggled with hitting these, you know, big round numbers. And that makes hashtag Dow 20K, you know, a big occasion for, you know, media obsession, social media frenzy over it.
And there has been a lot of skepticism about whether the Dow could get to 20,000 and some people thinking it would actually drop. Let's listen here to Harry Dent of Dent Research predicting back in 2012 that the Dow would actually fall to 3,000 points because of a massive debt bubble.
When these debt bubbles burst, every time in history you have had depressions ultimately, deflation in prices, and stock corrections that are not 40, 50, 60% like in the 70s, but
right.
60, 70, 80%. So this is the norm in times like this, and we're already getting
so close. What's causing the market to rise so much right now?
Variety of things. I mean, since the election, investors have been scooping up shares and selling government bonds because they're betting that President-elect Trump's proposals to cut corporate taxes, ramp up fiscal stimulus, all those things would accelerate growth. And, you know, this has really benefited shares of financial and industrial companies in particular. They've lifted the Dow Jones Industrial Average to 15 records since November 8th.
And, of course, we are waiting for the Fed to tell us whether it's going to raise interest rates as expected tomorrow. We saw a lot of volatility in the markets at the start of the year after the last interest rate hike. So that could play into this as well. But what might happen because of the Fed?
Well, you know, journal reporting is that there are really few expect that a rate rise tomorrow would ruffle financial markets. I think that there's more concern that the Fed could get more hawkish next year, and that could reverse the recent rally in stocks.
Now, you said that this is the fastest 1,000 points in Dow history?
That's right.
And
that's
so,
right. And
yeah, if you look back over it longer term, put the whole rise in context, up to 19,000.
Up to 19,000? Well, you know, it's been a long, slow rise. And I mean, since 1928, the Dow in presidential election years, not including ones with where there's an incumbent secret election, has averaged about 2.8%. And also the first year of a new presidential term sees the market rise by about 6%. So we saw something that's happened really quick with the Dow Jones gaining 13% since the start of this year. And about half of that increase has been since the presidential election.
They're calling it the Trump bump. Jason Bellini of The Wall Street Journal, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The new red carpet is the one leading into the Trump Tower in New York. There's been a parade of visitors walking past paparazzi. Today, it was Kanye West, the hip-hop mogul, who recently said at a concert that he didn't vote, but if he had, it would have been for Trump. He was then hospitalized for exhaustion and called off the rest of his tour. So, how to read the cultural tea leaf of his support? And how will the Trump administration impact arts and culture in America? We'll be chewing over that for months to come, but let's start today with Robert Lynch, CEO of Americans for the Arts. And full disclosure, Bob, your wife works for NPR.
Yes, she does.
She's executive director of institutional giving. So let's get right to the question that some people may see as self-serving. We are a nonprofit, but he has said he wants to cut back on tax breaks for charitable giving. That affects a lot of Americans. Are nonprofits worried?
Nonprofits are always worried about money in general, and 30% of the money for the nonprofit arts organizations in America comes from charitable donations. We work hard to educate leaders about the value of the arts and why those tax deductions need to stay in place.
Well, Sandra Swirsky, who's with the Alliance for Charitable Reform, is telling art museums and cultural institutions to call their big donors and tell them to make big gifts before the end of this year. To get that deduction. But that deduction, of course, applies to a lot of Americans who, you know, maybe take $25, $50 and give it to some kind of an art-related institution.
Well, it would have impact definitely broadly beyond just the arts to the entire nonprofit sector. We're very worried, and we're talking to Congress across the board about making sure that this change doesn't happen.
And when it comes to Donald Trump's own philanthropy, people have been trying to look to see what does he support. Not a lot when it comes to the arts, and he's been very open about that. He said he prefers to sink his extra monies back into real estate. But what about his relations with the arts? As someone wrote, he could be the only person in the world to give Hamilton a bad review. After the cast read that note to Vice President-elect Mike Pence, Trump tweeted out Hamilton was overrated. But he did try to produce a play years ago, and he saw Evita six times.
Well, we're going into this administration without a lot of information that we need. We did do a survey of every presidential candidate in collaboration with the Washington Post. Mm-hmm. What he said was that supporting and advocating for appreciation of the arts is important to an informed and aware society. That statement, at least, is an indication that he doesn't start out coming out against the arts. Mm-hmm. And so our job is to find out what that really means and who are the other leaders within the administration that might also have similar values for the arts.
Well, and he has publicly spoken about the arts on occasion, including in 1999 when he called for New York to stop funding the Brooklyn Museum. This was after then-Mayor Rudy Giuliani complained about a work from Chris Ofili that depicted a black Virgin Mary figure decorated with elephant manure. A lot of people found that offensive. Trump joined in asking for it to be defunded. Do you worry that he might step into those kinds of controversies?
I absolutely worry that we will be having additional controversies. I would expect that similarly to that battle with the Brooklyn Museum, we'll see points of view that are going to be challenging. Interestingly, Chris Ofili used elephant dung in very much of his work. It wasn't a particular comment on that particular religious depiction, but that's the way it was portrayed. So we have to do a really good communications job as the unknown comes at us.
Well, what else do you think, looking into the future? Presidents Bush, both of them, loved country music. The Obama family loved blues, and they had R&B musicians to the house. Donald Trump was host of The Apprentice, a pop culture sensation, and he will stay on as executive producer of The Celebrity Apprentice. Producer Mark Burnett is going to produce the inaugural with him. Is this making you shiver with fear that we're going from fine arts maybe to more of a leaning toward pop culture, or excitement, that there might be a broader sense of culture in the White House that more people can identify with?
Well, I think that it's one thing to look at what the president does in the White House, what kinds of art he will have in there. It's another thing to look at what kinds of policies he will pass. As president, Donald Trump has said he would eliminate funding to sanctuary cities, about 47 of them out there. Well, that includes arts funding. So there's both a practical side of all of this, and then there's the human side.
Robert Lynch, president of Americans for the Arts, as the art community wonders what a Trump administration holds for them. Bob, thank you.
My pleasure.
Several artists in Dallas have teamed up with the Human Rights Initiative of North Texas to share the stories of people who've been granted asylum by the federal government. That's about 24,000 individuals on an average per year. Many of them have harrowing stories and life experiences that go unheard. As Hadi Mawagdi of KERA reports, that's where the artists come in.
At a busy grocery store in Dallas, artist Chris Bingham sits down with a client who, for safety reasons, we'll call Nusrat. Nusrat tells Bingham about himself.
I'm 35 years old, and I'm married. I have a child, and I've been living in the U.S. Since 2011.
Nusrat is from Afghanistan. He was a translator for the U.S. military, and he came to the U.S. as an asylum seeker after a series of events, including the Taliban killing a close friend, his brother, and his grandfather. He and his family's lives were also in danger.
I lost my everything. I lost my family members. I lost my life and everything I had. And I feel sad whenever I think that I cannot go back to my country. It really hurts me, but it is what it is.
Nusrat met Bingham through HRI, the Human Rights Initiative of North Texas. Bingham is a muralist and an art teacher, and his work is a mix of graffiti, portraits, and images from pop culture. But his next project, for an HRI exhibition, is a series of paintings based on Nusrat's life. He and Nusrat discussed the need for anonymity.
The other thing, you know, I wanted to ask what is off limits. Like, I know that the face is off limits and the name. Also,
names and face, other than that, you can say, like, okay. You can express,
like, there's nothing in, yeah. Like, there's nothing that would, like,
after chatting for a bit, Bingham says his biggest challenge is going to be doing Nusrat's story justice.
I mean, that's the hard part, right? Like, you have the story you want to get across, and you want to get that story right. And so, if one piece is kind of off, you know, the story doesn't flow right. And so it's all about trying to figure out what's going to work and what's not going to work.
Bingham's concern is understandable. Nusrat's story is complicated. He didn't see his wife and young son for almost 5 years until they came to the U.S. to join him. Nusrat's mother is still back home in Afghanistan, so he's working three jobs to save money to bring her here. HRI Executive Director Bill Hostin says Nusrat's story is just one of many, but that once they get here, asylum seekers have a lot to offer.
They have unique skills. These are very educated people. We're talking about human rights lawyers and nurses, theology teachers.
Holston says that's a big part of why HRI teamed up with these artists, to inform people who don't know.
We also hoped that by having art, that we'd appeal to a whole different group of people than we've attracted to our events in the past.
At Chris Bingham's art studio, he describes Nusrat's paintings.
So it's a three-part painting series, I guess, that tells the story of...
The largest painting is set in the middle of the three. In the center of the painting is an outline of a man's face, but the face is covered with a lovely floral pattern.
And that represents his, like, loss of identity, loss of self.
Near the face are a handful of bees, which Bingham says represent the dangerous professional relationship Nusrat had in the U.S. military. To the left of the center painting is a maroon-colored canvas that features a large snake.
Snake, which represents death.
The third painting is an origami butterfly.
Butterfly, which then again represents rebirth and a new beginning.
Bingham says telling Nusrat's story was very emotional. There was a lot to take in, but he relied upon the skills he uses throughout his practice.
Most of my work relies on the narrative. You know, it's all about the storytelling.
The difference between this and the brightly colored life-inspired work that Bingham usually creates, the pain.
It's definitely a story I'm never going to forget, you know, and he's a person that I'll never forget because his story is captivating. It's heartbreaking. It's one of those things that just kind of makes you sit back and think about your life and think that, you know, things aren't so bad even when you think things are bad.
A sentiment Bingham hopes audiences will feel as well. For Here and Now, I'm Hadi Mawagdi in Dallas.
And if you're still looking for a holiday gift, it's your lucky day, because Here and Now resident chef Kathy Gunst is here with us in the studio with some of her picks for some of the best cookbooks that came out this year. Kathy, great to see you as always.
Great to be here as always.
And what do you look for in a cookbook?
Well, there were so many this year that my office, I look like a hoarder. There's just these tunnels of cookbooks. So I decided Ina has a new book, Mario has a new book, Bourdain has a new book. Like, what do I do? And I thought, I want new flavors. I don't need a new roast chicken. I don't need a new pasta sauce. I want brand new flavors. That's what motivated me. So we're going to start with that noodle dish you have in front of you.
These are dishes that you found in some of these cookbooks.
Yeah. You mean the one that's already empty?
The one that you kind of love already.
Oh, wow.
This is from a book called All Under Heaven, Recipes from the 35 Cuisines of China by Carolyn Phillips. Mm. And she lived in Taiwan for 8 years and then traveled through all the regions of China. This book is 513 pages. There are no photographs. There are these charming illustrations that the author drew. And the recipes are so interesting. So usually you have sesame noodles cold, right? Mm. How many times have you ordered? These are hot.
Yep.
And they have a spice and they have a depth of flavor. You add some of the pasta water to make the sauce creamy.
Oh, that's what does it. You
yeah.
cook it. That's like sometimes you can make spaghetti. You cook the spaghetti,
exactly.
all the ingredients together, and it comes out in this creamy way.
Right, because the starch from the water. So you make the sauce in a wok, and then you boil udon noodles or wheat noodles, and then you drain them and add them and add some of the pasta water, and you get this fabulous creamy dish.
Well, let me ask you, because you got your next book also we're going to hear of is from Taste of Persia. These ingredients, can you get them everywhere? Can you get the peanut paste that's in here?
Everywhere.
Okay.
I live in southern Maine. If it's in my grocery store, you can get it everywhere, trust me. Okay, moving along. The next book, this I just went nuts for, is called Persia, A Cook's Travel Through Armenia, Azerbaijan, Georgia, Iran, and Kurdistan.
Mm-hmm.
And this is by Naomi Duguid. And talk about new flavors. This, you know, you only hear about these countries in the news, and it's usually bad news. Well, this is good news. It turns out there are exotic, wonderful flavors in Persian cooking that we have yet to learn about. So you have in the
red
dish.
You've made us wait.
I have made you wait. I told them not to taste this ahead of going on air. This is yogurt that I drained for about half an hour so it thickened. Then I sauteed fresh spinach. Mm. And then you have caramelized onions on top. Toasted walnuts, but here's the key. See this here? This is saffron water. Mm-hmm. I took a pinch of saffron and a little warm water. It gets that gorgeous saffron orange color, and you drizzle that over the yogurt and the spinach, and then isn't that unusual?
It's amazing.
Really good.
Like, it's amazing.
I could just eat that all afternoon.
Okay, by the way, if you're at home saying, so could I, what is it again? Taste of Persia.
Taste of Persia, yep.
The other All Under Heaven. We'll have all of this at hereandnow.org, so don't worry now. Just luxuriate.
Just enjoy that Robin and Jeremy are having a delicious lunch. Just feel good about that.
It looks like you've got dessert here as well.
Yeah, but we're going to segue with kind of a tea cake. This is from a new book called Golden, Sweet and Savory Baked Goods from the Oven of London's Honey and Company. And this is a bakery in London that I had not heard of. This is a book by Itamar Srulevich and Sarit Packer. Lot of Middle Eastern flavors. This is a spiced carrot and walnut cake. Very fragrant and super moist, isn't it? Like you, with a cup of coffee or with an afternoon tea or as dessert. I've been eating it for breakfast, unfortunately. But what I love about this book is that the recipes, I've tried several of them, are perfect. They come out perfect. But some of the language is very flowery. Like, for instance, at the end of the carrot cake recipe, they say, quote, the end result should be lovely and springy to the touch.
Oh, you mean flowery with a W.
Yes. Like, usually I don't like language like that, particularly when I bake, because it feels vague, but it worked and it was perfect.
Okay.
You know, we need to make high tea a thing again and have
high
these.
Tea.
Yeah.
Let's do a segment on high tea.
Right, yeah.
Oh, there we go. A two-hour show, two-hour tea.
Right,
okay.
Right.
Okay.
And last but not least is Dory's Cookie by Dory Greenspan. And you may wonder, how could cookies possibly be new flavors?
Or a chocolate chip cookie.
Exactly. I took the most basic cookie out of this huge book of fabulous recipes. This chocolate chip cookie has some very interesting spices. And I don't know if they come through because they're very subtle. There's nutmeg in there and coriander. and there's sea salt in there.
I'll taste.
And I think it's the perfect crunch and chocolate balance. And you get a little bit of something that you're not quite sure what it is, and that's the coriander and the nutmeg. But this book is wonderful. She writes the most precise recipes. It's like being led by the hand by a real professional. And there are some really fabulous savory cookie recipes in there.
You mean like with rosemary and stuff?
Rosemary and parmesan. And then I did one with fennel seeds and sea salt. It's just a fabulous collection of cookie recipes.
Okay. And you still are into cookbooks. I know you're a cookbook author yourself, your new book, Soup Swap. But you're still into cookbooks, even though there are all those recipes out there online.
You know, I read them like people read travel books.
Yeah.
I dream. I get ideas. I find inspiration. And if you take a look at the number of new cookbooks published this year, it is not a dying art, for sure. Yeah. And we have a list of other books as well.
And plus you get to spill on them, and then your, you know, heirs can see that. Here Now, resident chef Kathy Gunstigan. Everything at the website. Kathy, thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin. Thanks,
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.